In our study of the properties that conformal symmetry imposes on theories that have that symmetry, and our ultimate goal is to extract the physical properties from conformal invariant theories. And in particular, one of the things that we will start doing is understanding the constraints that conformal symmetry imposes on observables. In the theory, and two, to determine the observables. How to use symmetries to, and some other properties that conformal field theory has that are very special, to determine exactly the observables, at least in two dimensions. So let me just tell you quickly the kind of what are the kind of observables that we want to consider in conformal field theories. So one should be, some of them should be fairly clear. One of them would be just the correlation functions, I mean, from the discussion from yesterday. The correlation function of local operators. So we're going to take, say, n operators living at points x1 to xn. And we'll be interested in computing the correlation function of these operators as a function of the various positions of the operators, as well as it will be a function of the dimension of the operators and the other basic properties of the CFT that we want to extract. The other one will be correlation functions. These perhaps are less familiar to you. Correlations of non-local operators. So these operators that I wrote down here are supported at points in spacetime. But conformal field theories, well, field theories in general, but conformal field theories in particular, can have operators that are supported on curves, some curves C in spacetime. And you can sprinkle some local operators if you want. And one of the things that we will want to do is to compute the correlation function of these loop operators. So these are operators now supported on curves, not on points, with, if you want, with local operator insertions in the plane. And also the other thing that will be very interesting and that has many implications to condensed matter physics is to consider the theory, the critical theory, not in a full space, but in a space with a boundary. So we will consider, for example, a theory in the upper half plane, okay? And we'll be interested in studying the response, the correlation function of, for example, some local operator in the presence of the boundary, okay? And this will have some nice physical information. So as you see, there are many different types of observables that you can construct in CFTs. I mean, there are many more than these ones, but this is just to give you a flavor. And what you want to do is to use as much as possible the powerful constraints that conformal symmetry will impose on these observables to, yes.
How would you define the loop operator?
Well, so this would take me far afield, but this is, in gauge theories, have you seen Wilson loop operators? No? I'll discuss them later in the work. So now essentially what I want to do before we can really use the powers of conformal symmetry to constrain the form of these correlators, first we have to understand what in more detail what conformal transformations are. So that I'll start by doing that, and then eventually we'll work towards this kind of, so this is kind of the target. Okay, so now I want to study conformal transformation. asymmetries of space-time. I mean, irrespective of whether there's a field theory that has that symmetry or not. So now we're just talking about space-time symmetries. But maybe as a warm-up, before that, let's first review something that should be very familiar. Not the conformal transformations, but Poincaré transformations. And I'll say it in a language which will make quite obvious how to generalize the notion of a Poincaré transformation to the notion of a conformal transformation. So what is a Poincaré transformation? So this is some transformation from x to x tilde, function of x. Say that maps a point x to a point x tilde. That has the property that it preserves the form of the metric. So if we're in flat space, so now we're talking about Poincaré transformation, so it's going to be the flat metric, eta mu naught. And here we can be either in Lorentzian signature. For most of what I say, there's no big difference between being in Minkowski space or Euclidean space. So we will both consider Lorentzian or Euclidean. So for example, here the signature will be minus, plus, plus, plus. So in general, I'll be working in D space-time dimensions. Or in Euclidean, the signature is all plus. And in terms of equations, what a Poincaré transformation does is essentially preserve the metric. So it means that the following is true. So if you make the mapping from x to x tilde, a Poincaré transformation preserves the form of the metric. Okay, so this remains the same. All that you did is change the coordinates here. Now, this can be written in a way that probably is more familiar to you, but it's completely obvious, is to write this as eta mu nu equals eta rho sigma dx tilde dx mu dx sigma dx mu. Okay? So the set of mappings x to x tilde that satisfy this equation, that preserve the Minkowski metric, are exactly the definition of a Poincaré transformation. Which are the, another way of saying it is that Poincaré transformations are the symmetries of flat spacetime. Or they're also known as the isometries of the metric, okay, of the flat metric, okay. So now it's in a straightforward exercise that you have probably seen to find the most general transformation x tilde that has this property. These are the Lorentz the Poincaré transformations. So let's discuss them a little bit. The general solution to this equation, you know, is that x tilde mu is given by a mapping that is at most linear in X. Okay, and now actually we will show now soon from the infinitesimal transformation. So right now this is an arbitrary transformation. X tilde can push you far away. It need not be close to the identity. It can map an arbitrary point to an arbitrarily far away point. We will soon focus on infinitesimal transformations that have the property that at any given point, the transformation maps that point to only a nearby point. These are transformations that are connected to the identity. So they almost don't do anything, but just a little bit. And so this is the most general Poincaré transformation. This guy, of course, you know what it is. It's a parameter associated to translation, space-time translation. And this parameter is associated to Lorentz transformation. And now by plugging in this general linear transformation that solves this equation, you can determine what constraints this matrix lambda has to satisfy. And in particular, what you find is just by plugging this into this equation, you find that eta mu nu is eta rho sigma, lambda rho mu, lambda sigma mu, which is the usual constraint that you know that Lorentz transformation has to satisfy. Written in matrix form, this equation is just a statement that you have a rotation, or generalized rotation, lambda, that preserves the metric. Okay? So if eta was just an Euclidean space, just the identity matrix, that would be exactly what an orthogonal transformation would do. An orthogonal transformation is a transformation that preserves the identity. If you are in Lorentzian signature, a Lorentz transformation is a transformation that preserves the Lorentzian flat metric. Okay? Good. And now, and this group of transformations, you know what it is? I mean, this has a name. So in four dimensions, just to be concrete, and in Lorentzian signature, this would be the group 013. Typically, in quantum field theory, relativistic quantum field theory, all that we require is that the field theory is invariant under the transformations that are connected to the identity. So another way of saying it is that this group of transformations, so something I should remind you, of course, is that the set of all Poincaré transformations form a group that's called the Poincaré group. And the Poincaré group has different components. One that has the property that the determinant, sorry, from here it's obvious that the determinant of lambda is either plus or minus one. And the transformations that, so this Poincaré group has four components, one in which the determinant is plus one, and the 0,0 component of the transformation is positive. This is the usual connected part of the Poincaré group, and this is in this case of the Lorentz group. And this is the part that should be a symmetry of all quantum field theories. And this is sometimes called the proper orthochronous Lorentz group. This includes all transformations that are connected to the identity. So namely, these are transformations that by moving parameters, you can go back to the trivial transformation. But then there are other important components that involve discrete transformations that are not connected to the identity. And, and you know what they are. These are involve parity, P, let's call it P, time reversal, P. So parity, of course, acts by reversing the three special coordinates, and time reversal reverses the time coordinate. And then you have PT, which is the product of the two, that reverses all coordinates. Okay. And a quantum field theory only has to be invariant under the connected part of the Lorentz group, and it may or may not be invariant under P, T or PT. For example, in the standard model, it's not invariant under parity, and there is no problem with that. Okay. Actually, any quantum field theory, but that's just as a comment, any quantum field theory has to be invariant under the proper orthogonal Lorentz group, but also under CPT, where C is charge conjugation symmetry. But let's not worry about this. Good. So now what I want to do is to explore, in analogy with Poincaré transformations, the similar structure that the conformal transformation will have. We'll now write down what the conformal transformations that preserve the metric up to a scale are. And we will see that, again, conformal transformations can be encoded into a group that has different components. And then we will study the physical properties of these transformations. Okay. Any questions about this? This should be mostly review, I think. But If not, let me know. Now what I want to study is, again, let's consider transformations. Infinitesimal transformations. So these are ones that map a point x to a nearby point, x tilde, which we're going to parameterize as x plus some vector psi. So I want to put all the indices like that. Okay. And we'll think of the psi as a function of x as a very small parameter. Okay. So that just barely moves any point to a nearby point. Okay. And this psi is a vector field that generates the transformation. Okay. And now I want to study what properties it should have. So now all that I have to do is to understand the properties that this infinitesimal vector field has to satisfy. All that I have to do is plug in this infinitesimal transformation into the definition of what an isometry is. Okay? So, yes?
Why do you write the psi as the psi mu mu, psi mu mu?
Because, I mean, that's how a vector field looks like. It's a derivative with respect to, if you have a very infinitesimal transformation, it's generated by motion on the tangent space, on that space, and that is a derivative.
So you like expand x to u tilde?
Sorry?
So you expand x to u tilde as a function of x to u?
Yes, so that's what I did. So this is an expansion. And now I have to tell you what is the functional form of chi that it has to have in order for it to be a function. So now all that I have to do is plug in into that equation. So let's just do it in some detail. And then I'll, for conformal transformations, I will not have to go through so many details. So now if I take x tilde equals x plus psi, this matrix of partial derivatives will have a delta function piece and a first derivative with respect to the parameter of the transformation. Okay? All I have done is just plug in that there. And now what I want to do is to analyze this equation. Remember that psi is infinitesimally small, so I have to analyze this equation to order psi. So let's start with order psi 0. Order psi 0 is a triviality. Just tells you that eta mu nu equals eta mu nu. The order 0 term is arranged by multiplying eta with this Kronecker delta. While the order psi transformation looks like d mu, so essentially arises by looking at the cross term here. So just d mu psi nu plus d mu psi mu equals 0. So this is the constraint that an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, Poincaré transformation, has to satisfy. And now it's really very easy to extract from here. And tomorrow in a tutorial we'll do something similar to that for the, not for the Poincaré transformations, but for conformal transformations. It follows immediately from this that this psi is annihilated by two derivatives. This is just really two lines to prove from here to here. I don't want to do it. So that tells you that infinitesimal Lorentz transformations, I mean, it confirms something that we already knew even for finite transformations, but it tells us that this psi mu is at most a linear function of the coordinates. Okay. So it tells you that psi mu equals a nu plus omega nu lambda x lambda. And now if I plug this back into the equation, we get the constraint that we know a lot, namely that this matrix has to be anti-symmetric. Okay? Very good. So what are the total number of generators that leave the flat space metric invariant? Well, we have, let's count. So number of parameters. the number of parameters we have, A is a d-dimensional vector, so we have D from here, and then we have rank 2 antisymmetric matrix that has D times D minus 1 over 2 components. So in total, the Poincaré group has these D plus 1 over 2 parameters, and therefore generators. There is one generator associated to each parameter that induces a Poincaré transformation. And of course, these parameters are associated to translations, the translation generators, and these parameters are associated to the Lorentz generators. Okay? So just as the set of Poincaré, of Poincaré transformations give rise to the Poincaré group, the set of infinitesimal Lorentz transformations give rise to the Poincaré algebra. Okay. So this is something that you, I think you know, that finite transformations form a group, but if you look at transformations that are close to the identity, very small transformations, the physics of those transformations is encoded in into the associated Lie algebra. Okay. And now, how do we compute the Lie algebra? You can compute the algebra of Poincaré transformations. So you want to compute another Poincaré algebra? You can always extract the information about a space-time symmetry algebra by looking at the commutator of the vector fields that generate the transformation. Okay? So if you take, I already said that there are two generators here, P mu. P mu is associated with the vector field that has the constant parameter. So P mu as a vector field is going to be like minus I d mu. These I's are a bit conventional, but this is the standard convention that you have like in quantum mechanics when you talk about a translation operator. And the rotation generators you can extract from the linear term in X, and it just looks like minus I X mu d mu minus X mu d mu. Okay? Is this something you've seen before? Yes.
I have a question about the previous. How did we obtain the second derivative of psi 0 from this?
Yeah, so that's something that I didn't show explicitly, but it's very simple. Take a derivative of this equation, and now write the same equation that you get there three times, doing a cyclic permutation of the three indices. Add two of them and subtract the other one, and you get that. You'll do something very similar in the tutorial. It's completely straightforward. But the basic idea is just to differentiate the conformal, the Killing vector equation. By the way, yeah, so this kind of equation is called the Killing vector equation. So now, just from the knowledge of the behavior of the infinitesimal transformation, you can compute the commutator. So I'm not going to do it in front of you, but you know how to do it. I just compute the commutator of these vector fields, and you indeed get the Poincaré algebra that we know and love, or should love. And then I'm not going to write it. There are three other terms that should be here, but those are fixed completely by symmetry, because remember that m mu nu is antisymmetric in nu and mu, and m is essentially antisymmetric in these two indices. So all I have to do is take this term and antisymmetrize with respect to mu nu and rho sigma. Okay, should write it down. Just this one sign. Okay, so if now I antisymmetrize, I don't make a mistake. That's also not trivial. So now I'm antisymmetrizing with respect to mu nu. Now I'm antisymmetrizing with respect to rho sigma. And now I'm antisymmetrizing with both. So I get eta mu sigma m mu rho. Okay? And this is the standard form of the Poincaré algebra. Yes?
The association with the of the generators with differential operators, under what spaces is that association valid? Like, is it only on scalar field spaces?
No, I'm just acting on functions, yes.
Like on any function of the coordinates?
Yes.
Okay.
When it, later on, when we act with the Poincaré or any space symmetric group on fields, apart from the kinematical part of the transformation that acts on spacetime, there is an orbital part that knows about what are the Lorentz properties of the field. So if you have a spinor or a vector, if you act with a Lorentz transformation on a vector, you'll induce a rotation like this, but you'll also induce a rotation on the internal space of the vector, on the mu index of the vector. But right now, this is just a representation of the Poincaré algebra on functions. And from that, you can just extract. So that the logic is that you solve these Killing vector equations. This gives you exactly the form of the infinitesimal vector fields that generate all possible transformations. And by taking commutators of such vector fields, you generate the algebra. Okay. Likewise, if you compute the commutator, well, it's obvious that the commutator of P with P is 0. The other last commutator you have to worry about is the commutator of Lorentz transformation with translation, and that just gives you. This essentially just tells you something that you already know, which is the fact that P is an object that has an index. So it tells you that under Lorentz transformation, P transforms like a vector. And this is exactly what this statement is. It's just a statement that P transforms as a vector under a rotation. What is the vector? OK. So this was for infinitesimal transformations. As you know, in order to get from an infinitesimal transformation to a finite transformation, you have to do something that we also do in life. So if you want to get very far, you have to do very small steps. So all you have to do is do very many infinitesimal transformations. And that essentially corresponds to exponentiating the transformation. Okay? So to go from here to a finite transformation, you have to exponentiate this generator. So you want to have a finite Poincaré transformation. What you have to do is look at the action of this is something you know from quantum mechanics. When you do a finite translation, you have to exponentiate the derivative. But this is a general statement. So this group element will generate a finite Poincaré transformation. Is this clear? It should be mostly things that you've seen already. But if not, I can answer. OK, so this was a story about Poincaré transformations. The thing that we're really interested in and that we still do not have yet much intuition about is what's the story with conformal transformation. But I already explained in the first lecture that a subgroup of the a subset of the conformal transformations are the Poincaré transformations. So that's why I wanted to start with this, which should be mostly familiar. So now let's really go properly to the conformal transformations. So the idea is very similar to this. That's why I started from here. And now I'm doing conformal transformation of flat space-time. Something that I did not mention, but hopefully you have some, you've seen in the GR course, maybe I may just mention it quickly. So here I was doing, I was asking what are the symmetries of the flat Minkowski metric. But you can always ask what are the symmetries. Instead of being on a flat space, you can be on a curved space with a metric. And you can ask what is the you know what? Let me not do this. Maybe leave this for an exercise. I just want to say that this equation, of course, is only valid for flat Minkowski space, and there is an obvious generalization of this if you're on a curved spacetime. But in this course, we will mainly work in flat spacetime. But I want you to think, or maybe a good exercise for you is to think, how would you modify this equation if eta was an arbitrary curved metric? Okay. And what would be the corresponding if you look at the infinitesimal transformation, what would replace that equation? What I call the Killing vector equation. How would it change if I'm considering the symmetries of an arbitrary curved metric? But in order not maybe to be simple for now, let's just look at a flat spacetime. So conformal transformation is, again, some mapping from x to x tilde as a function of x. That has the property that it leaves the metric invariant up to a scale factor. Okay. So in equations, all that it means is that instead of just the of these line elements to be the same, they can differ precisely by a scale factor. Okay. So in equations, it means that there is a scale factor which I'll call capital omega, eta mu nu dx mu dx nu equals eta 0, okay? And in particular, if I choose a transformation for which this omega, this scale factor, this guy is called the scale factor, for obvious reasons, because it's a rescaling of the line element. If the scale factor is the identity, you go back to what we already seen, which is the Poincaré transformation, okay? So now let's study this in a bit more detail. I can write this in a fairly clear way. Equivalently, I can write it like this. Okay. So we're looking at mappings X tilde that satisfy this property. Okay. And this will generate, these are the conformal transformations. The solutions to these equations are the conformal transformations. Any questions about this definition? It's a slight generalization of the notion of an isometry, which is a transformation that preserves the metric to a transformation that preserves the metric up to a scale. So now in order to develop some intuition about conformal transformations, let's first start with infinitesimal transformations. So now let's analyze infinitesimal conformal transformations. Again, these are transformations that are close to the identity. Okay, so all that I will do again is to let x mu be a small deformation of x, parameterized again by this vector field chi of x. And all that I have to do now is analyze this equation. Let's call this equation. Yes. To linear order machine psi. Okay?
What's the meaning of that? Will the scale factor be a function of x itself? I mean, what functions are possible to be, for example?
Any function. So we'll find them. Right now, we will find the most general solution to this equation. I haven't told you what this omega x is. We'll find what are the most general solution to this equation.
Mm-hmm. So it might be, for example, sine of x, for example.
Sorry?
Sine of x. Is it possible for?
No, we'll see that that's not the case. I mean, you have to consistently solve these equations. Mm-hmm. So there will be a very specific set of x tilde, a very specific set of chi's that will generate a very specific set of omegas. Otherwise, it will be not sufficiently restrictive. I mean, just like the Poincaré transformations are finite dimensional, when there's a finite number of generators, in dimensions bigger than 2, the number of independent transformations that you can make here that solve this equation is also finite dimensional. So you don't have complete arbitrariness in choosing this. Any other questions? Okay, so now all that we have to do is, again, expand this equation. And this guy will be small. Also, omega, of course, if I'm doing an infinitesimal transformation, the identity transformation is an isometry. So that means that omega will also have an expansion in a small parameter. 1 plus little omega x, which will be small. And now I just have to expand this equation to linear ordering in psi. So to order psi 0, you get, again, a trivial equation that eta mu nu equals eta mu nu. And now the calculation is exactly the same. That's why I did it. It's exactly the same as the calculation I did somewhere here. Maybe erased it. Oh, there. Yeah, so it's exactly the same as that equation there, except that on the left-hand side, to leading order in psi, now I have a term which is proportional to little omega, right? So what you end up getting is that to order psi, you get the equation that we already had, which was this d mu psi mu plus d nu psi mu. But now, instead of having 0, since the right-hand side, in that case, the right-hand side here has a non-trivial piece to order psi, you get here 2 omega x eta mu nu. Is it clear how I got this? I'm just really expanding the basic definition of a conformal transformation to linear order in the parameter. Okay. And now, just by taking the trace of this equation, which means contracting both sides with upper eta mu nu, that tells us how this omega is related to psi. It tells us that if I just contract with the metric, I get that twice the gradient of psi equals 2d times omega. So from here, we extract that omega of x is 1 over d, the gradient of psi. Let me do it. So that means that the equation that we have to solve, which is called the conformal Killing equation, generalizing the notion of a Killing vector to a conformal Killing vector, is the equation d mu psi mu plus d nu psi mu equals 2 over d And now I just plug in here omega in terms of psi. Derivatives of psi. Okay. Any questions about this? Yes.
Yeah. I don't understand why did you expand omega capital as one plus omega small.
Because I'm making what I was arguing is that it's an infinitesimal transformation. So it's very close to the identity. The identity transformation does not rescale omega. So to leading order, omega is just one. And if anything, you will have a small perturbation away from the identity. Okay. Another way of saying it is solve this equation that I wrote here, and you'll find that to leading order in psi, omega has to be one. Otherwise, you wouldn't solve this equation. Any other question? Yes?
How do you know that the omega and psi will be of the same order? And that omega.
I'm deriving it. I'm deriving it from this equation.
Hmm? Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's exactly what this equation is doing.
But that's the gradient of psi, not psi itself. But yeah.
No, but I mean, this is the solution to the system of differential equations to this order. That's it.
Yeah, yeah, but my question was about how you motivate this, that you can, how you can say that psi and omega is of the same order in infinitesimal things. I mean,
well, I mean, this guy is, the psi is a smooth transformation. I mean, I'm not sure what you're worried about. I mean, this just follows directly from the expansion here. Even if you didn't know what order of sigma is, you discover it here. I mean, you discover what sigma is from this equation.
But you're,
It's a consistent, I mean, the fact that sigma is this is a consistency of this equation. Follows from a consistency of this equation.
Yeah, but you're assuming that the omega.
If psi is small, why is the derivative of psi also small?
No, but if you wish, I mean, that's
the question.
Maybe ask me later. I'm not sure what.
No, I think that, I understand his point where here, well, Jacob, I think, says, I mean, you have the equation star, and you're deriving the conformal Killing equation from the fact that you assume that omega is of the order of psi, not, say, psi squared or psi to the fifth or whatever. You're assuming that it's of the same.
Well, I mean, when you do a power series until proven guilty, you have all terms there. So I'm saying that the first term is non-trivial. It could have been in a different universe that the first term didn't could vanish, but it doesn't. So I'm just doing a power series expansion in a small parameter, and I'm finding all the terms in the series. More questions? Okay, so now this is the beast that we have to study. Essentially, we want to find all solutions to this for flat space. Let me go to the board, maybe. And now I'll mention it, and I want you to go and think about it. Just like before, I just briefly mentioned that you can generalize the notion of what an isometry or a symmetry of an arbitrary curve metric is. The same is true for a conformal transformation. Given a curve metric, you can always ask what are the set of transformations that preserve the form of the metric up to a scale. And if you are really motivated, I want you to try to do this exercise. This may or may not be in the tutorial tomorrow, I don't know. I want you to try to see that if you try to generalize this equation, which I don't know if you see it. So this was equation, of course, was for Minkowski space, right? I want you to try to derive following this kind of logic. It should be quite straightforward. Show that the conformal Killing vector equation preserving the metric, the curve metric, up to scale, of course, is given by this equation. Essentially, it's an obvious equation. It's essentially the covariantization of that equation. That equation is very special to flat space. So the way you would covariantize it is by making all derivatives covariant with respect to the curve metric. So what you should get is this. And now here you get g mu naught of x times the gradient. Where this covariant derivative, just to remind you, is the partial derivative. But now, in a general curve manifold, of course, you have a connection piece. So this will have the connection part. OK. Very good. I think sometimes in order to understand a concept, it's better, it's good to try to generalize it a bit, and then it reinforces the original concept. OK, very good. So now, going back to our task, we're trying to construct the set of all possible conformal transformations in flat space, infinitesimal conformal transformations in flat space. So now we want to solve this equation. It's very similar to the analysis I did for infinitesimal Poincaré transformation. And in fact, that definitely you will have to do tomorrow in the exercise. You'll be essentially proving the following statement. So it follows just, again, by taking some simple derivatives of this equation that, and combining equations and really elementary algebra, that equation, let's call it star,
you use star before.
Yeah. Double star. Star squared. Thank you. It follows from this equation that the Killing vector, the conformal Killing vector, is actually now annihilated by three derivatives. That's nice. That already tells us that the set of conformal transformations will have to be finite dimensional. Why? Because the most general psi that I can write down is at most a polynomial of degree 2 in the coordinates. And that's, of course, finite dimensional. Notice that this is a degree of a polynomial 1 degree higher than for Poincaré transformations. For Poincaré transformations, what I showed before is that it was a polynomial of degree 1. Now for conformal, it's a polynomial of degree 2. Okay. Now, now you can just go ahead and write the most general degree 2 polynomial. So we'll have a constant part, a linear part, and a quadratic part. And in order to really fix what the form of the polynomial is, all that you have to do is plug the most general ansatz to the quadratic polynomial back into the equation, and this will tell you what the form of the polynomial is. Okay. And that's something also that you'll do tomorrow. So the general solution to this exercise of plugging the quadratic polynomial into that will give you that there are a total of 1/2 d plus 2 times d plus 1 real parameters. What the hell is that? Let's listen. It's okay.
Happy birthday.
I don't have that beautiful voice, sorry. And now let's see more explicitly how the parameters appear in the expansion of this quadratic polynomial. So there's going to be a piece that we already knew from before. It has a piece which is just a constant. We'll have a piece that is, actually there are two different terms that are linear in the coordinates. One with this omega, one like this. And then the quadratic piece is fixed to be of this type. So x squared minus 2x mu b dot. Okay. Where these parameters are, so a mu, b mu, and lambda are arbitrary, while, again, by plugging this back into the conformal Killing equation, we find again that omega mu no is antisymmetric, okay? Which you would expect. Okay, so now we can indeed see that this is the number of parameters that we have. From here, we have 2D dimensional vectors, right? So you have 2D plus one real parameter, one. And here we have a D dimensional, a rank 2 D dimensional antisymmetric matrix that has D times D minus 1 over 2 parameters. And if you sum these two, you get that. Okay. So in dimensions higher than 2, the set of conformal transformations is finite dimensional. There are a few more than the transformations that you would have in a Poincaré transformation. In a Poincaré transformation, it's obvious that the Poincaré transformations are the ones here. So conformal transformations have d plus one parameters. It has one transformation parametrized by lambda and another transformation parametrized by a vector v. Okay? And one of the goals will be to understand more precisely what these transformations are. Okay? Good. Let me see. Please, can someone tell me what this transformation does? I mean,
rescales.
Just rescales. And the other ones are some crazy thing that we will develop some intuition for in a second. Yes?
The last term in the equation, why didn't we contract x with a and b?
Why didn't I? What?
In the last term in this.
Oh, equation, this one?
Yeah.
That's what you get by plugging it back into there. Wow. And that's something that you have to derive tomorrow. But it's completely straightforward. It's not a mystery. Any other question?
Is that infinitesimal?
Yes.
So lambda is a small polynomial?
Yes. Yeah, so maybe to develop some intuition, it's clear what these transformations are. Let me just. Well, all are clear except the last one. For the last one, I'll have to do a trick to lead you to believe that it's not completely unreasonable. So it is clear. So let's analyze a little bit all of them. So what are these transformations doing? So the one that's parameterized by a mu. So for each parameter, just like for the case of the Poincaré group, for each parameter that appears in the conformal Killing vector, there's an associated generator that generates that transformation. So associated to a mu, we have translation. And notice that, remember that I was saying that we're looking at transformations that map x to x plus psi. And indeed, that's what we get there. For omega mu no, also we recover the thing that we know. You get a Lorentz transformation that map x mu to x mu plus omega mu nu x mu. the transformation parameterized by lambda. This guy we will call the scale or dilatation generator. And this should be obvious because it maps x mu to x mu plus lambda x mu. So all that it did is do a rescaling of the coordinates. Okay, that's why we call it a dilatation or a scale transformation. And the last one, which is parameterized by a vector, we call it k mu. And this has the name of a special, it's not a very creative name, special conformal transformation. And this one does something weird. It does precisely this kind of quadratic shift. So it maps x to b mu x squared minus 2x mu b dot x. OK? But soon we will get a handle on what the meaning of this is. Okay, so something I should mention is that what I'm writing here crucially depends on the fact that dimension is bigger than 2. We will see later in the course that in 2 dimensions something very, very special happens. Essentially, in 2 dimensions, the set of conformal transformations goes from a finite dimensional space of generators to an infinite dimensional space. And that's behind the richness of conformal field theory in 2 dimensions. And that allows us to solve many of the properties. But we will discuss that later. For the time being, let's stay in the generic case of arbitrary dimension.
But why can't we see this by looking at our calculation?
Yeah, you can see it. You can see it. So let's see it. Let's look at this equation for d equals 2. Or where do I do it? Let me do it here, yeah. I keep losing my... Okay, sorry. So let's analyze this equation in 2 dimensions. And let's look at this term by putting mu nu equals 1, 1. OK, mu nu equals 1. From here, we get that twice a1 psi 1 equals a1 psi 1 plus a2 psi 2. Okay. This is just the equation that a1 psi 1 equals a2 psi 2. Now, let's analyze this equation for mu equals 1 and nu equals 2. In this case, of course, the right-hand side vanishes, right? Because that's the flat metric. And from here, we get d nu psi 2 equals minus dtu psi 1. Okay. So the set of equations that you get are this. What is the name of these equations?
Sorry?
The Cauchy-Riemann equations. In order to see what they imply, you can introduce a complex, organize psi 1 and psi 2 into complex parameters, define complex coordinates. That's the power of 2 dimensions, that you have complex analysis. And then from these equations, it implies that the anti-holomorphic derivative of psi vanishes. Okay? So what this tells is that a conformal transformation in 2 dimensions is generated by an arbitrary holomorphic function. So any function, so the transformation can be generated by any transformation that maps z to an arbitrary function of z. Okay. And there's an infinite number of such beasts in 2 dimensions. We'll come back to this when we study 2-dimensional conformal field theory. But you see that it was, in fact, much easier to see it in 2 dimensions, to solve this in 2 dimensions than in higher. Yes?
But now you used
an Euclidean metric, right?
Yes, I went to Euclidean space, that's fine, yes.
Yeah,
yeah, so
if you don't do that, then you get anti-Cauchy?
Well, then you get either, you get a right moving wave or left moving wave. In this subject, model of some minor subtleties, it's completely equivalent to study things in Lorentzian or Euclidean signature. But the power of complex analysis is most manifest, of course, in Euclidean signature. But if you went to Lorentzian, you would have this nice interpretation as that things propagate at the speed of light. So any function that's purely right moving and or left moving, or sorry, in this case, purely right moving, right, generates a conformal transformation. Okay. So now that we have the explicit form of the conformal Killing vector that generates the conformal transformations, we can use the same trick that we used before for Poincaré group, and we can construct from these infinitesimal transformations the conformal algebra. And the way you do it is, again, is that if you do the commutator of two consecutive conformal transformations, you get a third conformal transformation. And that tells you what the algebra of transformations actually is. Okay. So let me just write it down once. So the Poincaré part, we already wrote down. The dilatation is x mu d mu. And the special conformal transformation is this slightly ugly looking thing. Okay. And now all that you have to do in order to see what happens when you do the commutator, say you first do a translation and then a dilatation, minus a dilatation and a translation, you want to see what kind of transformation you generate on the right-hand side. It's always the case, and that's something that you hopefully you know from GR, that if you make two transformations, the commutator of two consecutive transformations generates another transformation. Okay? And now we want to just find out precisely which transformation you get. Okay? So doing this exercise, which is completely straightforward, you get a list of commutators that generalizes the Poincaré algebra. And I would say that almost all of them are completely intuitive. And I think there's only one that's a bit subtle, that you have to do the computation to really understand why the answer is what it is. So for this guy, I'm not going to write completely again. That's the guy that we had before. These are the Lorentz transformations. Plus three terms. Then we have what happens when you do a Lorentz transformation and a translation. That also we know. Okay. So now we have to start thinking of what happens if I look at the commutator of a Lorentz transformation with a special conformal transformation. So can someone guess what the commutator of this will be? Yes?
Hopefully it will tell us that k is a vector.
Yes, so it will be
the same as for p.
It will be exactly the same as this, just replacing p by k. Exactly. So if you wish, this commutator tells you just something very kinematical, that k is a vector. What do you think the commutator of Lorentz transformations with the dilatation should be?
Zero.
Zero, because it's a scalar, so it doesn't transform under So I'm not, of course, I'm not going to write all the zero commutators because we're taking three black boards. But so good, that guy is zero. Again, this guy is just Poincaré, right? Now we come to the more interesting guys. This also already tells us something interesting. It tells us that if I look at the commutator of dilatation, so in the subject of conformal field theory, one of the things that we're very interested in doing is in diagonalizing. So when you do quantum mechanics, and say non-relativistic quantum mechanics, you're interested in diagonalizing the Hamiltonian of your system. In conformal field theory, the operator that we're more interested in diagonalizing is this guy, the dilatation operator. And precisely the eigenvalues of this dilatation operator is the gives us this anomalous dimension that was I kept talking about in the lectures. Okay. So this commutator tells us that if I have a state with a given dimension, delta, this looks should remind you a little bit like the algebra of the harmonic oscillator. You have a Hamiltonian, and you have A and A dagger, and you have the Hamiltonian times A dagger gives you back A dagger. So that equation, what essentially tells you is that if I have a state that has some dimension delta, and now I want to compute the dimension of the state P mu times that state, it tells you that this increases the energy of that state by one. Just like if you have in harmonic oscillator, you have the ground state and I act with A dagger, you increase the energy by one. It's exactly the same logic. Of course, we will study in more detail what is the tower of states that you get when you look at the Hilbert space of a conformal field theory, but this is just to give you some intuition that this is not completely crazy. It also has intuition that P mu has a mass dimension, and therefore it has a non-trivial scaling with the dilatation operator. So just like P mu is like a raising operator, K mu, the special conformal generator, is an annihilation operator. So instead of raising the energy, it lowers the energy. Okay. So from here, you should track that P mu, K mu are raising and lowering operators. For the dilatation operator. And finally, the one that's more peculiar is the commutator of P mu with K mu. And essentially what you get is, this in some sense is also almost fixed by Lorentz invariance and the scale invariance. Of course, not the coefficients. To fix this coefficient, so this, if you wish, are basic, actually, the signs here you have to fix by. What I want to say is that there are many terms in the algebra that are fixed just by kinematics, or your definition, and the rest of the coefficients are fixed by the Jacobian entities. So you have to make sure that the algebra closes, and that for example, tells you that there is a relative sign between the right-hand side of this commutator for P and K, and it also tells you the coefficient that you get here. Okay. You know what the Jacobian entities are? Yes? Okay. So this is the full form of the conformal algebra. Okay. And part of what we will do in this course will be to extract as much physics as possible from studying the properties of this algebra and the way it acts on the Hilbert space of the conformal field theory, how it acts on the correlation function of the theory, and so on.
Can I have a question? Does the last commutator have an interpretation?
Well, so yes. I mean, this guy essentially has opposite dimension. So the guy that can read on the right hand side is something that has to have no dimension. And the only guys that have no dimension is D and Eta mu. It has to be Lorentz invariant. So what are the two possible Lorentz invariant things that you can write down? It's essentially you can only use the metric and the Lorentz transformation. But essentially, the guess that you would have written down is just based on the fact that on the right hand side you can only write down objects with zero scaling dimension. And so some of the things that we will do is study in detail this algebra to extract lots of powerful information. In particular, so we will use the conformal algebra to do several things. Two of them that are particularly exciting is, on the one hand, we will find bounds in the spectrum of the dilatation operator, which is kind of the Hamiltonian for conformal field theories, that follow from very basic consistency conditions of quantum mechanics. Just imposing that the Hilbert space, the theory is unitary, that follow from unitarity. So demanding that the norm of all your states is positive definite will, without knowing anything about the CFT, about what the actual theory is, will tell us that the dimension will have to be bigger. For example, for a scalar field, just to give you an example. For an operator which is scalar and the Lorentz transformation, we will find that the dimension has to be bigger than d minus 2 over 2. Okay? And we will derive other such type of powerful bounds. And the other thing that we will use, of course, is to constrain the form of the correlation functions. So we'll use it to study the Hilbert space, but also the form of the correlators. Correlation. OK. Something else that let me just mention, because I think it's useful and interesting. Maybe but I'll just say it quickly. You can check for your own. Is that this crazy looking set of commutation relations can be packaged in a way that is, that looks exactly like something that you already know. Notice that I counted here the number of generators. It was 1/2 d plus 2 times d minus d plus 1. So it turns out that this algebra is completely the same, isomorphic, to the algebra. SO 2, d, if you're in a Lorentzian signature, or SO 1, d plus 1, if you're in a Euclidean signature. Of course, the number of generators matches, otherwise they couldn't be isomorphic. But more, you can find explicitly what the relation between the canonical generators of these orthogonal algebras and the conformal generators are. Recall that this algebra, this orthogonal algebra is generated by an object that has two indices, which is antisymmetric, where m goes from mu. So m will go from mu, which is our 1 to d that we had here. But we added, or d minus 1. Now we add two extra dimensions, right? This algebra will satisfy essentially the same algebra as the Lorentz generators do. Plus three terms. Okay. And now you can check that indeed, if you make the following map. If you say that L mu nu, so when you restrict your index set to the various values here, you get exactly those generators in the following way. So if you restrict to indices 0 to d minus 1, you get precisely the Lorentz generators. If you look at the component which has an index in the two extra dimensions, you get the dilatation operator. Okay, this D is not the same as this D. Let me put a D hat. If you put one space-time and one extra dimension, you get one half of P mu plus K mu. And if you put one space-time index with the other extra dimension that you group, you get one half of K mu minus K mu. So now what you can go ahead and check quite straightforwardly is that given this commutation relation that I wrote down here, that look a bit strange, but they're not, that by using that, you can just very simply show that you get exactly the orthogonal algebra in D plus two dimensions. And this is useful for many things. In particular, just a small parenthesis, because I cannot help myself about saying this, that the fact that a conformal group in D dimension equals the O 2, D de la Lorentzian algebra, let me say algebra for the time being, is the basic kinematical footing behind the thing I discussed very briefly yesterday, which is the ADS CFT correspondence. It tells you the conformal algebra is, by definition, the symmetry algebra of a conformal field theory. And, well, this may not be completely obvious, but you will learn this if you take the explorations course. The OD, 2 are precisely the symmetries of ADS. So just like Poincaré symmetry, Poincaré transformations are the isometries of flat space, O, 2, D are the isometries of a D plus 1 dimensional anti-de-Sitter space. And this kind of the zeroth or minus one order check that the ADS is the correspondence is not crazy. Both theories have exactly the same symmetry. Still crazy, but in a good way. Okay. So far, I've been talking about the infinitesimal conformal transformation. Now you might wonder, just like I did for the Poincaré group, I want to find out what the finite conformal transformations are. This is pretty obvious for all the transformations except the last one, the quadratic one. So there is a simple trick that also gives you some intuition about what these special conformal transformations are, which I'll describe now. Let me not erase this. So far, I've been considering conformal transformations that are connected to the identity. Okay, so these are transformations that map a point to a nearby point. But now I'll write down a transformation which is not connected to the identity, and it's a discrete transformation from which we will extract a lot of intuition about conformal transformations. So consider the following discrete transformation. We'll call it inversion for obvious reasons, you'll see. This is a transformation that takes x mu to x tilde mu, which is just x mu over x squared. Okay. So clearly this is a discrete transformation, because if I do it twice, I go back to the identity, okay? It's also obvious, and I'm not gonna check it for you, that it's a conformal transformation, because if I compute, if I just go back to the original definition of what a conformal transformation is, you see that such a transformation preserves the form of the metric with a very specific scale factor, which you can compute to be 1 over x squared. Okay. So definitely, this is a perfectly well-defined conformal transformation. So what role is it playing in conformal field theories? Let me tell you a couple of things. And how will it help us to understand the global properties of the conformal group? So far, I've been discussing the conformal algebra. I want to understand a little bit better what is the global property of the conformal group, just like it is useful when you look at Lorentz transformations to understand the difference between transformations that are connected to the identity and extra discrete transformations like parity and time reversal. Inversion is has many features similar with parity in Poincaré. Okay. So as I said, there are two, let me say a couple of things. First, I is not connected to the identity. That's clear because if you are, actually, let's think about Euclidean space for a second. If you are inside the unit sphere, the conformal transformations maps, this inversion maps the inside of the unit sphere to outside the unit sphere. And in particular, likes to map points that are near the origin, very far away from the origin. So this possibly cannot be connected to the identity. The other thing that's important about or peculiar about I is that it changes just like parity does for Lorentz transformations, changes the orientation of spacetime. That's another way of saying that this transformation is not really connected to the identity. Okay. And that's something you can check quite explicitly, quite easily. You can check that if I make this transformation, I reverse the sign of the orientation of the space, which is essentially captured by the Lebesgue-Civita tensor. Okay, and now I make the following statement. So we're interested in the conformal group. One way you can think about the conformal group that does not rely on going through this conformal Killing equation and so on is that the conformal group itself can be constructed. The conformal transformations can be constructed by combining Poincaré transformations with inversions. So if this statement is true, it must be true that by suitably acting with inversions on Poincaré transformations, I will also generate all the generators in the superconformal algebra that we discussed. Okay. So now, something that you have to be careful. To be more precise, the conformal transformations that we're interested in are the ones that are connected to the identity, just like for Lorentz transformations, we're interested in Lorentz transformations that are connected to the identity, are obtained by looking. So this generates some group, which turns out to be, not surprisingly, the O2, the group of transformations. Strictly speaking, I should use a different letter for denoting the algebra and the group, but they're different, but they're, of course, closely related. One is obtained by studying the group near the identity. But the more precise statement is that the conformal transformations that are connected to the identity are the ones that live in the connected in the connected component here. Okay? So that means that if I want to generate all the other generators in the conformal group by combining Poincaré transformations with inversion, I will have to add always an even number of times with inversion. Because inversion changes orientation, so it cannot be possibly connected to the identity. But if I act twice, it is connected to the, it is connected to the identity. So the thing that's exciting about this is that let me look at conjugation of the translation generator by inversion. I act with inversion, I do a translation, and I act with inversion again. these maps, x mu, and you can check this yourself, it's very simply, to x mu plus a mu x squared plus 1 plus a squared x squared plus 2a dot x, okay? And now what I ask you to see is that if I now, this is a finite transformation because this was a finite translation, but note that under if a is small, which means that it's an infinitesimal transformation, you precisely get the transformation generated, the infinitesimal transformation generated by a special conformal transformation. I wrote some work here. Well, you remember, I think, right? Well, it's essentially that guy, exactly, yeah. So what this tells us, that this was a clever trick to find out, so by looking at the conformal Killing equation, we only get information about the infinitesimal transformation. By doing this trick, what we found is the finite form of the special conformal transformation, okay? And now, it's interesting for you to check that I can also conjugate with all other elements in the Poincaré group. You get that. Also, you can conjugate dilatation. Interestingly, you get a minus sign. And this will have important consequences later when we study the Hilbert space structure of conformal field theories.
Any question?
Yes.
Can we obtain the dilatations? I mean, you see that we can, the transformations that we can get by combining Poincaré and inversion, it's only the special conformal transformation, right? But not the dilatation.
No, but the point is, if you look at the commutator, if I now do a special conformal transformation and then a translation, I will generate the right-hand side. So that's why it's really sufficient. Yeah. Any other question? Actually, I have to go to an exam. I'm already late for an exam. I should probably stop here. And is there some quick question that you have?
Yeah.
Or maybe we'll. Probably better that we continue tomorrow because I'm running late. Okay. Thank you.